This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. A new school board is sworn in. How will this impact the previous board's decisions? City Council stopped televising the citizen comment sessions, but now with new leadership, that decision may be reversed. Cardinal Healthcare is about to get or has gotten at least a partial new board as mandated by the state. Democrats walk out in protest at a Senate Judiciary Committee meeting in Raleigh. Anthony Fox has a new job in the Park Terrace Theater. Is closing. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. Tom Bullock is here from the WFAE newsroom. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist at Roll Call and a contributor to WCCB-TV. Ann Doss Helms is education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Glenn Birkins is editor, founder, and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Welcome back to you all.
Morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Use the hashtag WFAE Roundup, and you can watch us this morning on Facebook Live. So last week we talked about a lot about new city council and how the new young members may shake things up. This week let's start with the school board. This body too has what, three?
Three new members.
And not many young ones. No young ones, as a matter of fact.
Younger than me. And younger than you. So we get sort of young.
Well, that's true. The whippersnappers. And not many males on the school board.
One,
exactly. So, and we have a change near the top. Mary McCrae will serve a fifth consecutive term as the chair of the board, but only for 1 year. Is that normal?
Yes, they're elected for one-year terms.
She
could run again. I think she has said she's probably not going to. But actually, 5 years in a row is what's fairly unusual.
Okay. And then they chose the board chose Rhonda Lennon as the vice chair. Why did the board decide to make that change?
Well, on one level, it's just logical. I mean, she was just elected for a third four-year term. She will be the most experienced member. She has been a single parent of school-age kids through a lot of her time, and there are some family changes. Her youngest is about to graduate, so she has the time. But I think it's also important to note that she is a Republican. She's one of two Republicans on the board, and she is a suburban representative. And so I think this may serve as a signal to not only the suburban folks who have been, you know, there's always that tension that we've talked about a lot with the folks in the North and the South sort of feeling like, does this countywide board really represent us?
Yeah.
So there is that symbolism of having her in a position of leadership, and maybe also a signal to the Republican-dominated General Assembly in Raleigh that tends to be pretty skeptical of Charlotte. That, and again, Rhonda Lennon has chaired their Intergovernmental Relations Committee. She has connections with a lot of those legislators. Maybe sort of an olive branch to them saying, you know, we're not going totally partisan. We're not shutting you out.
Who was vice chair before?
Elise Dashew, who is a Democrat.
Did she want the job again?
I am not sure. Carol Sawyer nominated her, and Carol Sawyer, who is a new member, cast the only vote for Elise Dashew, and then Elise Dashew voted for Rhonda Lennon. So they clearly had agreed on that.
And you talk about Rhonda Lennon being a suburban representative. She represents District 1, which is the northern part of the county, and there are people in the northern part of the county who are not particularly happy with the school system, particularly with the bond issue that just passed,
right?
Because they felt cheated by that bond issue. What I'm hearing you say is that the board is making some calculated decisions or sending out calculated signals to the legislature, to the suburbs, and possibly to the northern part of the county, we're not forgetting you. We are going to remember you. Is that what you're saying?
I think so, yeah, and I think that's what they've been trying to say all along. It's anytime there's something, especially something really tense like student assignment, when everybody starts to fear that my school is going to be affected in a bad way, you start to hear a lot more talk about maybe we ought to have separate districts. You know, in the south suburbs, you've had, you know, Matthews and Mint Hill have this charter school proposal. There's a study that will be gearing up in the near future about whether and how one can split up a district. So I think the board and all of the members that are on there are committed to a countywide district that represents everybody. So they're going to be trying really hard to send messages to their constituents that we can do this.
I'm not sure what the vice chair of the school board does, but how might this change at that secondary position alter some of the things that the school board will do in the future?
As a practical matter, almost nothing. I mean, it's safe to say that the whole community is not abuzz about who's the vice chair of the school board for good reason. There's no big practical impact. It is really more the fact that we as the nine members of the board have come together, and there have been some times when it's been the Democrats are in charge here. We've put in, when Mary McRae was first elected and Erica Ellis Stewart was first elected, they put two brand new people, both Democrats, into the top two positions, and then they turned around and appointed a Democrat for District 6. So that was kind of the swing of the pendulum toward the, you know, Democrats are in charge here, Republicans step aside.
Let's talk about that for a second, because this is you've got a clear Democratic majority.
Yes.
You only have two Republicans on a nine-member board. So the Democrats put her in that position.
Yes.
What does that say about bipartisanship all of a sudden? Where is this coming from all of a sudden in this highly bifurcated world in which we live?
Well, I think the school board has always been less partisan. It's not. It is a nonpartisan election in that there's no primary and there's no D or R by any names. There's actually one unaffiliated member, Margaret Marshall, who was sworn in, and she replaces unaffiliated Eric Davis. And it's not to say that parties don't come in. You know, you see the parties during the campaigns, especially the Republican Party, because there tends to be just one Republican candidate for a district seat saying, you know, vote for these Republicans. But they have to kind of be able to work together.
And also when you have to spend on bond issues and get everyone behind you, I think there's a little more incentive to actually try to get everyone on your side, to try to at least have that focus on trying to work together.
I know school boards are obviously – their main job is – hopefully taking care of the school district and the students therein. But I do think – I want to go back to something you mentioned, Ann, because I think it's an incredibly salient point. I think having a self-described Republican as the chair of the Mecklenburg County School Board is an important
– Vice chair.
It's an important signal to Raleigh because – and this goes back to Mint Hill and Matthews. They have been pushing for a long time to have their own charter schools where their residents would get priority to fill the seats in those schools. And this would be different than the normal model for charter schools because that's district-wide. So I do think it's an interesting tactical move to try to help make the Mecklenburg School Board's case potentially to lawmakers in Raleigh, as you know, you really are getting these smaller portions of the school district stepping up and saying, we want something of our own. May not be a whole-on school district, but we want something that's ours.
So we talked a lot about the people running for school board in the last election, and now we have these three new members. Carol Sawyer replaced District 4's Tom Tate, who did not seek re-election. Margaret Marshall comes on board in District 5, replacing Eric Davis, who also did not seek re-election. And Sean Strain is in the District 6 seat, replacing Paul Bailey, who moved on to become the mayor of Matthews. That's only 3 out of 9, but are they likely to encourage the board to revisit some of the previous board's decisions, or are we going to just move forward from here? And I'm specifically, I guess, talking about student assignment.
I think it's very much move forward. Okay. I have not heard any of them say, let's go back and start over. You know, now Carol Sawyer, for instance, has one view of how they ought to pursue that, which is to move a little more aggressively toward moves that would desegregate schools. We have these paired schools that are going to open in August, and, you know, there'll be some let's wait and see how this happens, but she sees that as a potentially promising model that could be expanded. Sean Strain probably is going to be much more focused on the neighborhood schools. That's kind of the context in the southern district that he represents. You know, Margaret Marshall is going to be kind of where Eric Davis was. It's sort of the let's pull this all together. But she does represent the District 5, that is going to see a lot of this change. But so there may be a lot of tinkering. There may be a lot of specifics about how to execute this. But I have not seen and cannot imagine any push to say, wow, it's 2018. Let's start student assignment fresh. Let's tear it all up and start over.
So Mary McRae, who's the chairman of the board, how is the chairman selected? Is it a vote of the board? It's not by the at-large vote.
Nothing to do with what the voters, although often, you know, a strong showing might lead to that. But
did anybody run against her?
Nope.
So it's by acclamation, essentially unanimous. And she only wants to stay in that job for another year. This would be her fifth year. But she'll stay on the board for a year after that, correct?
Yes, they have 4-year terms, which may be tied into something we'll be discussing with City Council in the near future. But they have staggered 4-year terms, so the 6 district representatives just got their 4-year terms, and the 3 at-large will be up in 2019.
So in the spirit of American politics, since she's only going to serve for a year, who's going to replace her?
Well, one might conclude that Rhonda Lennon is sort of positioning for that. Mm-hmm. And again, chairman of the school board is not, they don't get an extra vote. They don't get an extra anything other than a whole lot of extra work. You know, they do a lot of scheduling and and meeting behind the scenes.
But do they set the agenda? I mean, would a Rhonda Lennon-led school board be different in some way in terms of the things that are important to the board or that the board will focus on than a Mary McCrae-led school board might be?
I think you only see the chairmanship role get really prominent in two situations. And one is where the superintendent is not a very strong voice or leader. And I think we are going to see moving forward how this particular combination of school board and Clayton Wilcox, who's still relatively new, about 6 months on the job, where that leadership comes from. I actually get the sense that he looks to the board a little more for leadership than perhaps some of his predecessors have. So that may be interesting to see. And in that case, it's sort of a do you have the presence? Are you the person who's saying we need to go in this direction? But again, the chairperson is only as effective as their ability to pull together the rest of the board. So when that doesn't work well, you'll see it. Yeah, I mean, we've seen in the past sometimes when the school board spends a lot of time arguing among themselves or deadlocked among themselves. So Mary McCrae has led the board through some times when they've looked really great and some times when they've looked really not great. You know, when the whole Heath Morrison thing blew up and they decided to not tell the public what was going on, Mary McCrae got a lot of criticism for that, and I think probably deserved some of it. But, you know, the fact that they're sticking with her says maybe they're happy with the way she's led them through that.
Still don't know why he left. Andos Helms, of course, is an education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, among other duties there. Let's move on to city council. And there was a story this morning at the last meeting, Braxton Winston, one of the new members of city council, suggested that council change themselves from 2-year to 4-year terms and consider giving themselves a pay raise. Has this been floated before?
Well, the idea with 2-year to 4-year terms is that gets floated every once in a while. I mean, I don't think it's brand new. And it is interesting because if you think about the job of city council, it's, you know, you can make a parallel with the U.S. House of Representatives. If you're being elected every 2 years, how much time do you actually put into running whatever body it is that you're on? It can be a huge distraction, especially for people like with our council right now, where you have, you know, 5 members who have never served before who have a pretty steep learning curve that they're going through. Whether or not it has its merits, we can certainly, you know, debate through all of that, but it's not exactly a brand new issue. As to city pay, I mean, I think most people will be surprised at how little city council members or the mayor, for that matter, are actually paid. But then again, they're not supposed to be full-time politicians.
Braxton said some interesting things. He said, look, I know Mayberry is set in North Carolina, but Charlotte is no Mayberry. The people in Charlotte should have a full-time government. And he said that council members are essentially serving people for only the first year of their 2-year terms because every 2 years you have to run for office. This is just like Congress now, is what I'm hearing. Does it really take that much of an effort? Does it take a full year to run for office?
I would hope it does not. I've never held office. I've never run for office. But I would hope that it doesn't take a full year to run for city council here. I think his point is well taken, or maybe it was Luana Mayfield's point that a lot of what they do is talking with constituencies about potholes and fixing things that these voters are not going to staff. They're going to the elected officials.
We'll come back and talk more about this idea in a moment. We have to take a break at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and TRCW, a specialty shop for women built and headquartered in Charlotte, featuring clothing and accessories from Italy, France, and America, located in Phillips Place. Details at trcstyle.com. And Novant Health, whose cancer specialists and nurse navigators offer customized cancer treatment plans in the community. More at novanthealth.org/cancercare. Well, Monday, we're going to talk to Mecklenburg County's new chief prosecutor, Spencer Merriweather. He takes over from Republican Andrew Murray. At Murray's recommendation, Merriweather says the criminal justice system faces skeptics today, and that's okay. because he believes in the short time in office that he needs to change things, shake things up, and he already has some proposals to do just that. We'll talk about those proposals and initiatives and more with him Monday on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Gelton. Coming up on the next On Point, an upset victory in Alabama, a deal on the tax bill, a subway bombing in New York. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The roundup of the week's news continues with On Point from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks. Here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. I'm told the most popular show of the week, and that is because Tom Bullock is here from the WFAE newsroom.
Hardly. Thank you.
And because Mary C. Curtis is here from Roll Call and WCCB-TV, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. So this idea has been floated, and it's been floated before, but it was floated most recently at the most recent city council meeting by Braxton Winston, that the council ought to go to four-year terms, staggered four-year terms. Mm-hmm. The at-large seats, I think, in the even-numbered years and the or they're all even-numbered years. The at-large seats.
Well, either way you set it up, you would split it. You would bifurcate it basically between the at-large seats, which are seats that are elected citywide, and the specific district seats.
Right.
And the mayor would run during the
at-large years. So council makers right now, council members make $19,809 in salary, plus a general expense of $5,800, a $4,000 car allowance, and a $3,100 technology allowance each year. I'm not sure what you spend $3,100 a year on technology. But anyway, the total pay is $32,709. And I think Julie Eisholt said, when you break that down into the number of hours each council member spends doing city business, it's about $6 an hour.
Yep. And that's actually a fair comparison. I mean, North Carolina, and I've said this before, so forgive me for repeating it, but North Carolina is in love with this idea of part-time lawmakers. Well, when you are now in a modern era, part-time lawmakers means nobody is going into city council to make a career out of that. And that may be a good thing in some minds, but there's a flip side to this that I do think is worth pointing out. When you're talking about, you know, an overall salary, and what you're talking about, Michael, the numbers that you just ran down, that's not all salary. That's, you know, other things that you have to turn in expenses for. You do run the risk of creating a de facto political class where somebody who, you know, may have the best interest of the public at heart but doesn't have a job that allows them to spend a whole lot of time doing something else may not be able to run for office. And that itself is something that's worth considering. Right. Do we want to live in a city, in a state, or in a nation where you have to be a lawyer or a doctor or a financier of some form in order to be able to serve in government even at the local level?
I'd be curious to see how voters would react to that. The one time, was it 2005 or with the county commission?
When most recently, 2015, I think.
Was it 2015?
Yeah, they keep coming back with the 4 years, and the voters keep saying no thanks.
Right. So we have some indication, at least as far as the county commission goes, how voters feel about that.
They went to four-year terms, but the county commission makes more than the city council.
No, the county commissioners are still 2 years.
Yeah, they're still 2 years. They proposed going for it.
Okay, excuse me. But they did, in June 2016, voted to increase their take-home pay from $30,000 to $43,371. Right. So they make more than the city council. Do they do more?
I think that's awfully hard to compare. And I think, you know, with any
–
you
answer.
Have members that spend huge amounts of time going out and meeting with constituents and maybe some that do less. You know, I'm sure people do a lot of things electronically. How do you clock the hours? But – and the school board, which has the four-year rotating terms, makes a whole lot less than either one of those boards. I don't have the number at hand, but it's significantly less.
In Charlotte, I do think, though, that people almost expect that we have a full-time mayor. They treat it like that, and it's not like that at all. And when you go outside, and I explain to folks our kind of part-time mayor situation, they all think it's quite odd that a city as big as Charlotte,
yes,
with the amount of demands and really crucial things happening in the city, have what is, in effect, as you said, Tom, someone who's supposed to do this as a part-time job.
And I'll throw myself in that, Mary. I mean, honestly, when I first moved down to Charlotte, which was, you know, just over 3 years ago, I was surprised, mm-hmm, to find a major metropolitan area, you know, a big city, where the mayor is more or less a cheerleading position. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but personally, when I moved down here, I was a little surprised that that Charlotte ran on a city manager weak mayor system, because I was so used to seeing the exact opposite.
And it's interesting, given the weak mayor system, that the mayor makes more money than the city council. The mayor's salary is $25,636, and when you add in all the other perks, not perks, but necessities like the car allowance, et cetera, it's $43,500 and change. What I thought was interesting about this proposal is that Bob Hageman, who is the city attorney, said, and we live in a state, what's it called? A Dillon rule state, where the legislature runs everything, and they have the power to run everything. And our legislature right now seems to really want to run everything, particularly in cities like Charlotte and Asheville, where they've taken control. I think the Water Works or something. They wanted to take control of the Charlotte airport.
Borough, and you can point to others.
But we have the power to make this decision on our own. How can that be?
For now, anyway.
And it's interesting.
Glenn's exactly right. I mean, that's the thing. We can make
back
it
tomorrow.
And apparently they could go to the voters, as the county commissioners have done, and say, do you want us to have staggered four-year terms? Or they could just say, no, we're going to do it.
Well, there's something else that went on at the city council. The last city council decided to take away the TV show, but they took away television coverage of the citizen comment meeting that happens every once in a while, and it runs about 30 minutes, and they decided to stop televising it. Why?
This happens actually twice a month.
Okay.
And it's a general part of – it's a pretty important part of what the city council does. And the answer is simple. The city council was under attack verbally by people who are angry and about, frankly, the Keith Lamont Scott killing and the protests afterwards. And the city council took what I see as an unusual step, and they said, okay, we're not only are we no longer going to televise this, which they have done as far as I can tell since they launched GovTV, but they also moved it to a smaller room to cut down on the size of the audience. And I on the show, I said, I think that's a terrible decision. If it's public comment, if part of your job as an elected official is to hear from the public, then it should be televised. It should be in the same room. It should have all the same characteristics as every other meeting. Why is it that a zoning meeting would get more, you know, exposure, as it were, than the twice a month when the city council is supposed to listen to the people who elected them?
Yeah. Braxton Winston evidently televised on Facebook Live the last session of this. Was that before he was on council that this happened?
He did it from the dais, and I love that.
He did it himself. Now, obviously, the audio and the video was not quite as good as GovTV, but he's the guy spearheading this effort to bring it back. Is there political will to bring it back?
I think it's going to be hard to keep saying no to this. It just seems like that's one of the – if you're going to say we're a more transparent government, we're listening to these new voices, that's a gimme. They're not going to be able to solve affordable housing quickly, but they can bring back the public comments on TV. Yeah.
Was the decision to take it off television because of the topic being discussed, the Keith Scott shooting in reaction to it, or because of the language being used by some of the people making those comments in the audience? And if you can go – this is not on the air television. This is on cable, right?
Yeah. Well, it's not. They don't have a broadcast tower, but it's.
So they're not governed by the same rules that the FCC. You don't have to be on a 10-second delay. Although you could be, I suppose, and you could bleep the bad words. But if you went to council and sat in the chamber, you'd hear those words. What are we so afraid of?
That's an excellent question. I think to some degree it shows how much our elected officials on city council, at least, are afraid of the people. Because, I mean, this was the people's meeting. These were the opportunities for voters to confront our elected officials in city council and say what we think. And as Tom said, I think it's a horrible idea to shut that down, but not just shut down the televising of it, but to move it to a smaller meeting. That sends a message that we don't want to hear from the people who put us in office.
But maybe that's one of the reasons, obviously, that Braxton Winston and so many young folks were elected to the council to shake things up and to change it. And they were the voice of the people. And if that's what – that was the message of the election, he's delivering as promised.
But I do think it's important to note, and this is not my thought. I just got this in a text, and – he is exactly right. Charlotte has been unique in the fact that they did televise these. Not every town, you're not required to televise these. You're not required even to hold the citizen, meetings. But Charlotte did it.
Televise the general meeting or televise
the
comments?
The comments. But the point of the matter is if you're going to start doing that,
yes,
you should stick with it.
Right. Like anything else, when you give something and take it away.
Why wouldn't you?
If
you have the technical capability of televising something, a public meeting, why wouldn't you do that? Even if GovTV didn't exist, why wouldn't you stream it?
Well,
today,
here's an enduring question. Why is it that the General Assembly has certain rooms when they're meeting, committee rooms, that has a public stream so you can listen to exactly what's happening wherever you're at on the internet, but other rooms don't?
Well, couldn't it be that some business needs to be done in private because you can't be negotiating deals in full view or you can't get anything done?
I'm talking about committee rooms where you're supposed to have – your public is invited to sit and listen.
Right.
But
there
you
are literally closed sessions that are spelled out by law. You are allowed or required to do this privately. But then there are public meetings, and maybe you can't or don't televise every committee meeting. But it just does get weird when you say this is part of our main event. Mm-hmm. And the public part, we're going to put it somewhere else.
But your point is well taken. In the age of Facebook Live, hi there. In the age of Facebook Live, it's actually kind of silly to say we're going to take out the cameras. Even concerts now have pretty much given up on the idea that that they're going to be private and that they're not going to be broadcast. These singers or whoever, it used to be no recording.
Right.
They've pretty much given up on that.
It was interesting to note, maybe it was the novelty of it, but Braxton's live stream, which was, as we've noted, is not very good quality, had about 1,300 views as of last night, which shockingly is more than we generally get for our Facebook Live of these roundtables.
I don't believe it.
How do you know that? I don't know that. How do you know that?
You look on Facebook Live and or you look on the website. We're getting significantly less than that for most of our Friday roundtables.
Why don't we use some more colorful language?
More
colorful language.
I hate to break this to you. I know this is hard to take, but this is actually a radio program.
It is that.
So we do have listeners on the radio, and I, for one, I'm not going to go there. At the first meeting of City Council, they also approved $1 million upgrade to the traffic light system uptown. Hallelujah. Praise the Lord. What will this do? Nobody knows.
It's $1 million.
It's supposed to make traffic flow more smoothly.
Yep, exactly.
Well, we'll have to have some people on to find out what this is going
to
do.
To be continued.
They also voted to accept a $1.7 million state grant to double the number of B-cycle bike sharing stations around the city. That means that the number of these stations will grow to around 51. And there are now, I think, three different bike sharing programs around the city.
Actually, I think five from what I was reading.
Okay.
That are very visible.
Which one is this? Is this the white bikes with
the blue and white bikes that are actually at the docking stations.
Okay.
The others are just kind of scattered. You see them on the sidewalks and various places. This was our first bike share program.
Okay.
It's primarily funded by Blue Cross Blue Shield and Carolina's healthcare system. And most of those stations are in parks and
the hospital logo on the chain
and the Blue Cross logo.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's that one that they voted to expand. Actually, the other two, I just call them the orange bikes and the lime green bikes. They have permission to double the number of bicycles that they have on the street as well. I went to a meeting recently of Center City Partners where they talked about that, and what they're trying to do is just to make Charlotte more bike friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of what we're going to see in the future, we're going to see more bike lanes, we're going to see more bikes out. They're trying to get people out of their cars, people who live close in, people who live in Center City, to keep their cars parked and take a bicycle instead of driving.
Well, there must be demand if they're expanding the number of stations. Is it based on demand or is it based on reach? If we put a station way out here, maybe somebody will use this bike.
I know the B-cycle program has seen steady increase. I can't say about the other two; they're fairly new. But they have seen a steady increase in the number of people who are actually riding those bicycles. Unfortunately, I don't have the numbers.
Okay. And the spin and the Lime bikes, you just use an app. You don't have to go to a docking place. You use the app and you pay the dollar, and that somehow unlocks it, and you ride it and you leave it wherever you're going. And really, just within the last couple of weeks, I work at the NASCAR Tower, and the Lime bikes in particular are just all over the sidewalks now. And the orange spin ones, I'm seeing more of those. So I think the idea is you get those out there, and people who are not using it now, maybe I start walking by it and saying, oh, maybe that 4 blocks down to my parking garage, I could just, you know, tag it with my app and roll downhill.
You have to think that all those people that are filling all these new apartments that are going up downtown and or uptown would look at them as a possibility.
I think at some point they're going to have to deal with that problem of these bikes being all over the sidewalk. Currently there are 250 lime green bikes. There are 250 of the other bikes. And as I said, they've got permission to go up to 500 each. And already we're seeing them on the sidewalks, turned over here. I think they're going to have to figure that out at some point.
This is apparently a huge thing in China. I remember reading something recently. They're years down the road of this, and that even with competitors like hauling each other's bikes and putting them in weird places, it's just the dynamic of bikes on the sidewalk is a huge issue.
They have a bike culture.
Yes.
China, because they had more bicycles on the street than cars until very recently. CMPD is proposing that Charlotte join other cities in the country in establishing what is called a family justice center. There are about 120 of these around the country, described as places that bring legal and social services for victims of crimes, domestic violence, and other forms of trauma under one roof. Why this now?
Well, I think there's a number of different reasons. I mean, unfortunately, we're finding out more and more when it comes to the city's homicide rate that domestic abuse is playing a significant role in it. And if you think about, if you put yourself in the position of a victim, if you need help and you need different stages of help, the last thing you probably are positioned to do is to go through the different hurdles of getting all the – figuring out where you need to go to get each different thing.
And in fact, this is going to be a cooperative effort between the DA's office, CMPD, and an organization called Safe Alliance.
Correct.
And the CEO of that organization, Karen Parker, says the current system is in fact difficult to use.
A lot of victims do maybe reach out for help one time, and then they get in the system, and then they get frustrated because they're not able to get what they need. So they may return to the perpetrator, and then the violence continues.
So is this underway? Where does this stand right now, this attempt to formulate this, I guess, service?
My understanding is it's still being, you know, set up, this single center where you can get help with all these different things. I mean, everything from talking to a DA about and police officers to potential charges to having someone there to help you with the social help that you may need, you know, be it a place to live or whatever. I mean, this is a model that's been used in other cities, and it's been used to some good effect in places specifically like San Diego. But I applaud the effort. I'm not sure exactly how far along they are, but I do believe this seems like one of those situations where you're putting the needs of the victim first and trying to help them stabilize their situation so that way they're not forced to revert back to the same situation that kicked it all off.
And I don't know how much of this is because of the recent high-profile domestic violence cases we've had. But this year, we've had at least two domestic violence incidents that resulted in multiple deaths.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And it makes sense because if you want to prevent these things in the future, as you said, Tom, if you treat it as one particular case, it'll come back again and again. But if you look and actually take care of all the circumstances around it, maybe we can reduce those numbers and get some results.
Yeah.
The last thing you need to do if you're a victim of crime, you just have to run through the hurdles and the red tape and all that stuff. It would be nice to go to one place and have it all
definitely
for you. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the ever-changing story revolving around Cardinal Innovations Healthcare. It's Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Doctors Making House Calls. Physician-owned and managed, Doctors Making House Calls works to help complex patients stay healthy at home and avoid unnecessary ER visits and hospitalizations. Details available at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. And Steinway Piano Gallery, Charlotte, welcoming the holidays with music, offering a factory selection event through December 31st, featuring new and pre-owned Steinway Boston and Essex pianos. Steinway, PGCH.com. Well, continuing on point, the roundup of the week's news continues with a look at Doug Jones' victory over Roy Moore in Alabama, Republicans nearing the final passage of a tax bill, and a bomb goes off at the Port Authority bus terminal in New York. A panel of journalists gather for a look at those headlines and more at 10 o'clock, 20 minutes, as a matter of fact, at 10 o'clock on WFAE's On Point. And we're coming right back with our news roundup in 30 seconds.
2018 is coming, and so are those New Year's resolutions. So why don't you resolve to be more informed? Tune into Morning Edition every day, whenever it fits into your schedule. You can multitask. You can listen while you're making breakfast, doing other things. You can even listen while you're doing sit-ups to deal with that other resolution. Discover your world and hear stories that dig deep. The Gym and Morning Edition are waiting when you're ready. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup, streamed by few but heard by many. With Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Glenn Birkins from QCityVentra.com, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call on WCCB, and Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. I got to tell you that all of the questions I had about Cardinal Innovations Healthcare in preparation for this show today, Tom, are no longer valid because...
Sounds familiar. Welcome to my world, Mike.
What has happened just in the last 24 hours? So let's talk about this. Earlier, I think it was earlier this week, they constituted a search committee to choose members for a new board of directors.
Correct.
At least one member of that search committee, George Dunlap, who's on the county commission, was also on the old board.
Correct.
And he wanted to be on the new board.
Correct.
What has happened as a result of all this?
He is now on the new board, along with two other former members of Cardinal's old board. And this is one of the more interesting twists here. For people who have not been following the saga, and I still think that is a perfectly fair word to describe everything that's been going on at Cardinal over the last year in particular, when the state took over Cardinal Innovations Healthcare on November 27th, one of the first things they did was dissolve the board of directors.
And they did so why?
That's simple, because behind all of the scandals, behind the excessive CEO pay, behind the severance packages, behind all of that was the board. And the board continually, not always unanimously, but they did continually vote in favor for all of it.
So they dissolved the old board because of what the state construed as not necessarily misdeeds, but bad decisions in terms
well,
of compensation,
their term exactly
et cetera.
Was serious financial mismanagement.
Okay.
And go ahead. I'm sorry.
So now we have a new board. Mm-hmm. With three of the old members on the new board.
Well, and
how much sense does that make?
Well, at least three. We are not exactly sure of the makeup of the new board. We know of these three people because we've been reaching out to them. Alexandra Olgan, our colleague, has been doing this, made these calls yesterday. George Dunlap confirms he is on the new board. Brian Thompson is on the new board. Now, he was an interesting case because the same bizarre meeting of the board in November, where they finally said, we've had enough with Richard Topping, he's not going to take this state-mandated pay cut, we are going to fire him. The term they used was terminate his contract, but we're going to allow him to stay on for two more weeks. Before that, there was this really fascinating 90 seconds, right when the meeting kicked off. And in that 90 seconds, you have one of the board members, one of the more powerful board members, a gentleman by the name of Steve Uhas, immediately launched by saying, one of us, basically members of the board, has been acting in bad faith and we need to get him out of here right now. And within literally 90 seconds, Uhas made this pitch. They voted and Brian Thompson, who is a lawyer, was forced out. They basically just said, leave your iPhone on the table and get up and go.
And what does that mean, acting in bad faith? What was he accused
Nobody of? Said what that was. And we've tried numerous times to try to figure out exactly what this was. Board members of the former board tried to point us down this way and that way, but none of it seemed exactly right. So we started going back through board meeting mm-hmm. minutes, mm-hmm. and it also turns out that Brian Thompson, who is now going to be on the new board as well, was the only person who voted against, the only board member who voted against on record this bonus structure for then CEO Richard Topping that capped up to 40% of his salary. So you could imply what you will there. So he is back on, as is another county commissioner So it is an interesting twist, and there's still more that we're waiting to find out about this, and we're told that we should know more of who the full board is.
How many people on the board?
Between 11 and 21.
That's a floating number?
But it's as mandated by statute, yeah. It has to be at least 11, but it can be as high as 21. Okay. And as of right now, we can only confirm three.
Is it odd that a member of the selection committee who was also a member of the former board and also voted to put himself on the new board, is that odd?
Everything about the setup of this, you could argue, is odd. I think it's fair to say, because when people think of boards of directors, especially for an organization like Cardinal, who is in charge of, you know, $682 million in taxpayer funds, drop the taxpayer bit. If it was a private company, the board selection process would be pretty rigorous. This is mandated not by shareholder value or, you know, investors. This is mandated by state statute and federal guidelines. And the qualifications necessary to make that board is there are some, but not many.
I don't know whether this question is any longer germane to this conversation, but I'll ask it anyway. The revenues of this organization are around $700 million a year. And Mecklenburg County Commissioner Bill James expressed skepticism recently that they would be able to quickly find board members who would be qualified to run an organization with that kind of revenue. Do others agree with him? And are the board members that we know about deemed to be qualified to run a company of that size?
Let me answer these in reverse order. Are they deemed to be qualified? They were deemed by the nominating and election committee that picked them for the job. All three of these that we know of have also served on the board, but this board has been controversial. So you can take with that what you will. As to your prior two questions, this is something we have to wait and see. And I will say this, lawmakers who have been following the Cardinals story so very closely, they also are beginning to worry about whether or not a board that is picked in the style that Cardinal, and it's not just Cardinal, like all of the other similar organizations statewide, they follow the same rules for picking their board. The reason we know this about Cardinal is because of the state takeover and all these other things that have caused us to have to elect a new board. The question there is, they're worried about whether or not, state lawmakers are worried about whether or not these individuals can hold the fiduciary responsibility that a board of directors is supposed to hold, which means they need to act in the best financial interest of the organization they run mm-hmm. and that they're there to guide.
So the state came in essentially and took over the organization a couple of weeks ago and got rid of the old board, and now they're putting in a new board. Is the state in any way supervising the selection of these people? Could they just turn around and say, nope, this is not acceptable, we're dissolving this one too?
You ready for this? No.
Know what?
They cannot. They have no – and I checked this with Secretary of Health and Human Services for the state, Mandy Cohen. Uh-huh. The state has no veto power nor authority to do anything. The only time that they can step in and appoint a member of the board is if the board itself failed to be constituted, or if there are certain – because there are certain categories that also have to be represented on the board. And if those categories aren't met, then the state can step in. But in reality, let's take the apocalyptic scenario, as it were. If the entire old board was reelected, the state would have to say okie dokie then.
And Tom, we were talking about this before the show. Don't we have yet another complicating factor of a whole new lawsuit filed?
Oh, yeah.
Is it Richard or Robert?
It's Richard. You keep wanting to call him Robert.
You talk to him. I don't. Richard Topping, who is the former CEO, has filed a countersuit.
With the former board, with some members of the former board.
Meaning what?
As with everything, it keeps getting fascinating. So at heart of this are the what one lawmaker calls the gilded parachutes for four particular Cardinal employees, although there were more who possibly could have taken them. And this is the $3.8 million severance packages that listeners have probably heard us talk a lot about.
Right.
So Richard Topping and some members of the former board are now suing the state, saying that over this last weekend, the state and, you know, Cardinal's former CEO and some members of the former board came up with a settlement. And this settlement was supposed to help resolve all this stuff. But the last second, the state said, no, we're not going to do this. And Richard Topping and some members of the former board said this is all because of political pressures. So they have now petitioned a court to enforce this, what they see as a settlement. And the former Cardinal folks want to make it public. Now, the trick here is this. I am not a lawyer, but I know, just being me, and I think most people would agree to it, that I'm not sure you can call it a settlement until the ink is dried and both parties have signed.
Yeah.
And there was no such signed agreement.
Yeah.
However, I'm curious to see how this plays out in court because maybe there's a twist there that I don't get.
Okay, before our heads explode, we're going to move on. This will probably go into the new year anyway. Let's talk about, not probably. Tensions in Raleigh are not getting any better as we approach the end of the year. Lawmakers were debating whether to change how judges are picked when all the Democrats on a key committee walked out of a committee meeting. Why? Who wants to do that one, Tom? You're back on.
I'm happy to talk, but I didn't want to hog the microphone.
Roy Cooper's representative wasn't able to speak.
Wasn't allowed to speak.
Wasn't allowed to speak, and there was some objection to that.
Well, that committee is run by Charlotte Republican Senator Dan Bishop, who said before the meeting that since Governor Cooper's choice of the person to speak was not an employee of the governor's office, he would not allow him to speak. That person was retired Judge Don Stevens, who would probably have brought a point of view that would be contrary to what most of the Republicans on the committee want to hear. Is that the reason he wasn't allowed to speak?
That's certainly what the Democrats feel. I mean, without question. And I do have to say this. There is no – I mean, Senator Bishop, as the committee chair, has the right to allow whomever he chooses to speak or deny that right. It is distasteful in some situations, maybe depending on your political point of view. It is his right and ability. But if you are trying to change the way that the North Carolina Constitution mandates that we, you know, elect judges, and that's what's going on here. They're talking about not just redistricting, but they're also talking about making it a selection process instead of election process. One would hope it would be more transparent.
And also, if you were trying to change what people think of the culture in Raleigh, that perhaps they actually want to accomplish some things in a bipartisan manner, you would act in a different way. But we have seen that that is not the choice that is made.
So meanwhile, the Republican-controlled legislature passed a law that did away with primaries next year in partisan judicial races, and now state Democrats are suing in court. On what grounds?
Say that again.
Say the whole thing again?
Yep. Sorry.
I said you were checking your phone, weren't you?
Yep.
Republican-controlled legislature has passed a law that did away with primaries in next year's partisan judicial elections, and they are now being sued in court by state Democrats. Why?
Because they did away with the system that they thought, you know, was mandated by the Constitution. I mean, the interesting thing here is we have seen a number of just fascinating cases of redistricting going on in North Carolina this year. And this is the latest twist. And a big part of it, the Democrats certainly say, is the Republicans are tired of losing court cases. So they've decided rather than change their laws or their tactics, they'll change the courts. Republicans counter that this is something that hasn't been changed in far too long, that the districts are old, that they are not representative. And in fact, the courts have not been changed, the districts and everything, for decades. But this is really the political tribe like warfare over a separate branch of government. We're used to seeing it with the executive branch and the legislative branch, but now it's just jumping into the judicial branch.
But I think more than that as well, given the Republican supermajority, I think they feel that having an R behind a judge's name might give that judge an advantage at the polls.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We recently had a big change in the makeup of the Charlotte City Council. It is now younger. It's now majority Democrat. Was before. Yesterday, County Commissioner Dumont Clark announced that he will not run for re-election next time in District 4. That would be next year. Filing doesn't start until February, but he put this out yesterday. I'm not sure why so quickly, but he says he's seen an unprecedented level of interest from a group of highly energized younger Democrats who want to run. Is there a deeper meaning to all this interest? Is this due to the Trump election waking people up, causing younger people want to get involved in politics? Or is it simply a time for a change of generations at the helm?
I think it's fairly common for somebody who has served a long time, and if you keep getting reelected, you're very hard to defeat. So if you're ready to step down, it's pretty common to put out the signals early to let somebody know, you know, and you want it to be somebody that you would like to see in that office. So you want them to have time to gear up a campaign, you know, to sort of sort out whether they have the support. So, and I don't remember the number of years, but Dumont Clark has been there for a number of years that makes you think it would be reasonable for him to step down.
Tom.
Yeah, and I don't think you need to go all the way up to the Trump administration. I think part of this is quite simply look at the success of first-time candidates for the Charlotte City Council. Mm-hmm. That race came first. So do I think that more people are paying attention to politics right now and there's a lot of excitement about politics? Sure. But you also look at, you know, five brand new members being elected to the Charlotte City Council. There are people who think, well, maybe that's time for the same thing to happen in county government.
And while you don't want to put everything at Trump's door, I do think you see energized people, people who hadn't been voting, coming out. And so people want to see where it carries us.
So former Charlotte mayor and former Obama-era Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox has been chosen to lead a new commission to examine Davidson College's ties to slavery. This is Davidson College looking into its own past. Glenn, why now?
Well, this is part of an ongoing grappling with our past, with our slaveholding past, our national history. Colleges and universities all over the East Coast, primarily, have been doing this and looking at the connection between their history and slavery. We found some that benefited directly from the slave trade, and so Davidson has appointed a commission to look at it as well.
There was one letter to the editor saying that Davidson shouldn't be looking back, it should be looking ahead. But can you look ahead if you don't look back first, Mary?
Yeah, history, of course, it is the pathway to who we are. And, of course, this is an institution of learning. And who better than Anthony Fox, the first, I believe, African-American student body president at Davidson, to do this in a good faith way. We see Georgetown, which actually, as you said, you know, alluded to, Glenn, sold slaves. We see all these Northeastern great Ivy League universities looking into their slave past. Why not Davidson? Why not? And I think that just enriches. And it shows that we are all a part of this tapestry. And so we shouldn't be afraid of that. We should look clear-eyed. That's the only way we can move into the future.
So we don't have time now to talk about the Park Terrace Theater closing. It's kind of a landmark, and people are upset about that in some ways. But you said just the other day, just before we started, Glenn, that you walked past the place and didn't know it was still open.
The very next day, they announced it was going to close.
You had some offbeat films there, though, some nice, quirky art films. And Charlotte needs more of that.
Yep. Meanwhile, the Panthers are ahead of Atlanta, tied with New Orleans in the standings in the whatever conference they're in, with their breathtaking win over Minnesota. We're 9-4. The Falcons are 8-5. This week we play Green Bay. They're 7-6.
Aaron Rodgers might be back. He's an artist.
Go Panthers. All right. Thank you all for the hour.